it's just me texting. This is just like, you know, if I'm really responsive to something, I'm going to look at it and I might send it out.
That'll take you forward. So there's one little bit of introduction left, which is the Ein Yaakov. You got sort of skipping over everything between the Ramban and the Ein Yaakov. But that's the text that we're going to be using. The question is, what is the Ein Yaakov? Where does it come from? It's certainly, certainly the most important and most popular collection of Agadah ever produced. It was written or compiled by Rav Yaakov Ibn Habib. Rav Yaakov Ibn Habib was a Sephardi, a real Sephardi from Spain, who fled at the time of the expulsion. He fled, as many people did, to Portugal, and then the Inquisition came a little later to Portugal. And eventually, he ended up in Salonika, which was, what did you say? No. He ended up in Salonika, which is in modern-day Greece, but then was part of the Ottoman Empire, which was pretty welcoming, from what I understand, to Jews fleeing the Inquisition. And Salonika became a major, major Jewish center in this period, really one of the major Torah centers in history, from what I understand. He was there. He served as a communal rabbi and a posek. And it was there that he composed the Ein Yaakov, which was published in 1516. It's really one of the most published books in Jewish history after that. Extremely popular. There's a whole culture of Ein Yaakov, which has sort of disappeared, but it's very recently disappeared, of Ein Yaakov Shiurim. There were Jews who learned, you know, there were Jews who said Tehillim, there were Jews who did Chumash Rashi, and there were Jews who learned Mishnayos, there were Jews who learned Ein Yaakov. That was like a fundamental text of study, and then you had Jews who learned Gemara.
Wasn't it the
Tzenerim? Tzenerim is for women. I don't know. I've never read Sen or Ren. It's not clear to me that it would be mutter for me to do so. But I've never read it. But my understanding is that it draws on a lot of different types of sources. Among them, Ein Yaakov. They might say Ein Yaakov because they want to admit that the author of the Sen or Ren actually opened a Gemara. But the Sen was written by a man. No, it's written by a man. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know why you would necessarily.
I think that some Sephardi place.
It could be, but they, okay, I don't want to get distracted. My understanding is that Sephardim don't, that this whole thing of learning at night is like an Ashkenazi invention, that the Sephardim have a tikkun. They have a text that they say. That tikkun is a very fixed text, and they say it, it's like davening, and they say a tikkun. So, I don't know, but.
Do we know the guy's name?
Yeah, yeah.
What's his name?
Yaakov ibn Habib. There's a, someone wrote a dissertation, someone who has actually taught in Ramaz, my sister was there, now teaches at JTS, wrote a dissertation on the Ein Yaakov. She just has, I mean, just no end to the information about Yaakov ibn Habib. I mean, I just skipped over, and then he ended up, but she had ended up in Salonika, but she has like 5 pages of scholarly debate about what happened to him in those 3 years. And the answer probably is, we'll never know, and it's not going to affect anything, but people going back and forth, the possibility that maybe he actually was a Murano, or did he go to Northern Africa? And it's like it's very clear. The answer is we don't know, but it doesn't stop people. I don't know. But so now, what is the Ein Yaakov? The Ein Yaakov basically is a collection of all of the Agadah in the Gemara. So what it really is a photo negative of the Rif. I'm just thinking about the photo negative is going to be one of those terms that someone's going to write an article explaining what a photo negative actually used to be, so you can understand when someone says something's a photo negative. But so
everything the rift didn't include,
right? In other words,
is there anything that's not in either?
Probably.
Oh, cushion.
Yeah, you know, there definitely is, because the Rif cuts out lots of stuff. The Rif doesn't just cut out Agadah. The Rif cuts out, and he cuts out all sorts of, you know, pilpul things back and forth. He'll just cut to the chase. So, no, the Rif, there's certainly plenty of stuff that's not in both. But conceptually, they're sort of parallel. And this isn't, the Rif, and as I mentioned before in talking about the history, the Rif is sort of the forerunner of this entire trend in medieval Judaism of codes, of getting, of boiling down, instead of having halacha part of this long, discussion back and forth with agadas spliced in the middle, you just boil everything down to the basics, what you need for halacha, what you need to know. And this then moves to perhaps the greatest of the codes, the Rambam, who at least has an all-inclusive notion of what goes into a code, because the Rambam, first of all, covers all halacha, whether it's relevant or not. And he's the first person to, and he also starts with these philosophical basics. It's a book. I mean, it's meant to be all of Judaism, as we'll see, other than the Tanakh. It's supposed to be the whole thing. The tour cuts things down significantly because he only deals with what he sees as practical halacha. He's not trying. He's trying to produce practical halacha. There's the focus, and there's a much more pragmatic. The Rambam still has an idealistic, all-inclusive vision, even if it excludes Agadah. But the tour already, it becomes more pragmatic, more in line with the Rif. And finally, the Shulchan Aruch, which ultimately is most influential and important to these sorts of codes, which was published more or less the same time. I have the number of years here somewhere. But more or less the same time as the Ein Yaakov. And the argument that this woman makes for the dissertation, what's her name again? It'll come back to me. Very yucky name, Lehman. Marjorie Lehman. She argues that this was sort of a redress, that the Ein Yaakov was an attempt to redress this problem, redress this overemphasis, this notion that Judaism, it can just be reduced to these practical halacha. And what she basically argues is that he really was in favor of a more natural integration of halacha and agadah. But in order to do that, he had to restore the place of agadah by putting it on a pedestal and putting it in its own space. That was the idea. He also wrote a commentary which is on this, which is, I think, is the Ein Yaakov proper, the commentary, which is always called HaKotev.
Come in.
This is the text that we're going to use. I guess the bottom line is the most convenient text for going through Agadah, if you want to do the Agadah of the Bavli. However, as we said, it's just not always clear how he comes to what's in and what's out.
Agadah in the Gemara?
Well, like I said, our whole point was these terms, Agadah and Halacha, are really problematic terms, and that they flow into one another. And so deciding what's halacha and agadah, and that the whole distinction is to a certain extent artificial, which is why to put too much weight on the distinction is problematic, and to put too much theological weight and say that one is from God and one is just something some random person said is very problematic. Okay. But so it's all a question of calls. But some of his calls, from what I've seen just preparing this, I've never really used Ein Yaakov before this, is some of his calls are hard to figure. And
it's too much or too little?
Well, I'm not necessarily noticing the too little, because I haven't been systematically going through. I've been looking at the Gemara, but I haven't necessarily. I could easily have missed stuff. So far, it's too much. So far, it's stuff that just looks like straight halacha, and as we'll see, we'll go through it. And if anyone has any ideas on what makes it agadic,
But his purpose was to make a book of agadah.
Right. His purpose was to make a book of agadah. Mm-hmm. But given the fact that this is a sort of it's a difficult thing, but that it's a tough call to make. What's going to go in and what's going to go out? You can always argue with his calls, and we'll see, and we'll discuss what we think about some of his calls, whether or not it goes in. If I find something that I think should be in, we might do it. But the part of the idea is the convenience of not having to of just going straight through this. So. The Ein Yaakov, by the way, and this is a standard edition, I think they're all more or less the same, also has a whole slew of hakdamot, which picks up, which is why I said it gets much too complicated once you get past the Rishonim. Not the Rishonim are straightforward, but at least you can get a handle. So what you have in here is you have the introduction of the Ein Yaakov to the Ein Yaakov, to Agadah, which I haven't found it, but supposedly contains one of the most famous midrashim that doesn't appear anywhere in Chazal, which is that they're the most important pasuk in the Torah. Once and one Tana says that it's Yavta Recha Kamocha, Rabbi Akiva. One Tana says that it's Ela told us what? Shema Yisrael, does someone say? And someone says Ela told us Adam. Is that
Keveth Echad?
And then one says that the Keveth Echad does have a book, but the Chazal is not Sevein Harbayim. That Shita is the darling of so many Darshanim. Mm-hmm. And it's just the Medrash says. I mean, this is the whole thing with the Medrash says. And it's this famous Medrash that everyone knows and no one can find. And apparently the only source is here. Now, does that mean he had an earlier source, or does that mean he just made it up? It's hard to tell. I haven't seen inside. I mean, I don't know what. I haven't gone through the whole introduction. But that's what the introduction to the Ein Yaakov is famous for most of the people who have never bothered to read it, like me. But then you have the introduction of the Maharsha. Of all the commentaries that are here, the Eitz Yosef and the Anaf Yosef, which is an important commentary on lots of different midrashim. But then he also has the Ma'amar al Odot Drashot Chazal of Rav Avraham ben Rambam, which is one of the most important works on Agadah, which for our purposes is subsumed under what we call the Rambam's position. But then he has, what else does he have? Darkei Agadah Vadrushim, who is this? You can say. You have the Ramchal. You have the Maritz Chayis. A lot of the major statements on Agadah of the Achronim are all collected right here in very small print. So that's the Inyan. Now, he opens with the first Mishnah. It's not clear to me why exactly. Does he do it for context because the Gemara, the Agadot are going to be referring to it? Does he think it's Agadic? I don't know. What? What, just that it's a Mishnah? What? Oh, it was a boring class or something. Sometimes interesting stuff inspires doodling. Okay.
More than one page,
it's
more than one hand.
Maybe
it
wasn't
this is not his handwriting. This is. Don't worry about it.
We're starting the Mishnah, and the Mishnah, in fact, there's a whole Torah of that, because the most important caveat of the Mishnah is caveat Kaufman, which I don't know who Kaufman was. But I was kind of some collector whose name it is, which still sits in Budapest. And Tavia Kaufman famously has at least three or four hands on, I don't remember. And the whole analysis of knowing the hands, of knowing when you see something, which hand it's in. Because there's the original author, but then there's the Nakdan. One of the important things about the Tavia Kaufman is that it's Menukad. That's how we have the Mesorah. The whole thing of the Mishnah, we have the Mesorah of how to pronounce it, which you don't have anything else really other than Tanakh. And so, but the Nakdan doesn't always agree with the original sofer.
In other words, the sofer puts in the nikud, and then the nakdan comes along and corrects it?
No, but when he puts the nikud in, you can see that if that's the nikud, then it shouldn't be spelled that way.
Doesn't matter.
In other words, there's an extra vav in there. What's that vav doing? Obviously, he thought that there's supposed to be, that's a cholam there, and he just has a patach there, whatever it is. Because he has, so there's, and then there's also at least one level of, when things get scratched out and fixed, is that the original guy making a mistake? The whole art's knowing who scratched that out. Was that some later guy who scratched it out? Or is this the original guy? And then that's just stupid to get worried about a mistake that he made and then corrected immediately. So the handwriting, the whole analysis of these different layers of handwriting becomes the whole thing. I usually hope I can find someone who understands this stuff. And because I'm just aware that it's a problem. Okay. So the first Mishnah, though, since it's here, does allow us to really... Since this isn't just the first Mishnah in Brachot, but at least as we have it, it's the first Mishnah in the Mishnah. So it really allows us to really encounter the whole notion of the Mishnah and what is it, and that will take us into some of these questions of the relationship between Halakha and Agadah. So let's just read the Mishnah first. Just read it through and explain it, and then we'll get back to what it means. It starts, Meima Taikorin Shema Ba'aravim. Yeah, Ba'aravim. Something's Ba'aravit. What do you have? Ba'aravim also? Yeah, okay. What? What do you
mean? We have Arvit.
You have Arvit. In the Mishnah, you have Arvit. In the Gemara, you have. Okay. Misha shekohanim nichnasim lachol trumatan ad sof hashmur harishona. Right? So when can you start saying Kriyat Shema at night? From the time that Kohanim go in to eat their truma, whatever that is, whenever that is, ad sof hashmur harishona, until the end of the first watch, whatever that is, whenever that is. Divrei Rabbi Elazar, the Chachamim omrim ad chatzot. You can say it all the way until chatzot, till midnight. It's pretty clear cut. We know when midnight is. Though how they knew when midnight is a different question.
Well, Shaul's money is no.
That's part of the midnight. Still, that's part of the even Shavuot Zmaniot. Even during the day, there's the problem when Chatzot is because is that still midday? That's why Chatzot doesn't move so much. Mm-hmm. But what?
Probably tell by the stars.
We'll get to it. They're going to discuss the stars. We'll get into the stars and what you can tell and can't tell. We have an expert on the block on this, so I've been able to get a little information without going too hard between the internet and Steve Phillip. I've been able to figure some stuff out. Okay. Rabban Gamliel Omer, Ad She'ela Amud HaShachar. Okay, that's once again a clear cut. Until dawn breaks. Ma'aseh Uva Uvanav Mibet Mamishteh. His, Rabban Gamliel's sons came from home from a wedding, apparently late. Amru Lo Karinu Et Shema. They said, well, we haven't said Shema yet. Amar Lehem Im Lo Ala Amud HaShachar Chayavin Atem Likrot. So he says, you have to say it until you can, and therefore you have to say it until dawn. Okay. Lo zil buvad, and not only this, lo zil buvad amr, they didn't just say this, but el akol mash emru chachamim ad chatzot mitzvatan ad she'el amud hashachar. That any time it says that you have to something still chatzot is a soft break. It's not really it's not the real deadline. It's just one of these fake deadlines to make sure that you get there on time. You know, it's like my grandmother having her clock running 5 minutes ahead, you know, to make sure, and will tell you what and doesn't adjust either. She'll tell you, you know, it's time to go, just so you don't miss your train. So what are those things? Hekter chalavim va'ivarim mitzvatam ad she'yala mud hashachar, the burning of various fats and animal parts which need to be burned at night after which are left over need to be burned at night can be burned until amud hashachar. Korbanot also, which can only be eaten for one day, the mitzvah that one through that night, and that night means until once again Amud Hashachar. In kein lama amru chachamim al chatzot. So if that's the case, well, why do they say al chatzot? What's the right? Kedei larchik adam mehavera. So there's people shouldn't get too close. You have to really wonder. You know, the psychology of all this, it's like, okay, so, but now the cat's out of the bag. I mean, once you know that, so the chatzot thing only works if people, like, don't know it, and then they only find out after in the emergency case. But, like, you know, they've sort of, Chazal was sort of like, they didn't want to tell everyone that it was till dawn, so they thought people would put it off, or they'd fall asleep, or what have you. So instead, but now the Mishnah comes and tells you this, so I don't know exactly what's left of that ad chatzot.
Yeah, but you know, we have these lechatchila b'diavad concept now, so.
No, you won't find a shul which has a minyan after chatzot. You see minyans at 11 o'clock at night, but you won't find a minyan which is scheduled.
First of all, in this town, you can find minyans for anything in any hour.
It's not scheduled, though.
Oh, you think there's what's called? You think that what the shtiplach here they don't have scheduled minyan until like 10, 11 in the morning?
You very rarely see.
Well, it's because okay. It's also are you going to get a minyan at 4 in the morning? But anyways, okay.
And the Gemara also adds that if you say it after chatzot chayav mita and all kinds of things like that.
Okay, but the Gemara has to compensate. Yes, you know. Okay. Now, right. Now, the question is, let's start from the beginning then. What is the Mishnah? What's its purpose?
Got to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere, that's true, but by deciding where to start, you have to know where you're going. What's the purpose?
Going to cover everything.
What's Mankrishma?
The Mishnah in general. What's the point?
What's the book of the Mishnah written about?
Oh,
yeah.
Not this
Mishnah. It's the Torah Shebal Peh.
Torah Shebal Peh, and therefore what? And how is it supposed to present it? So the Gemara is also Torah Shebal Peh, but it's clearly a different book. Right?
In other words, what is the content?
What is its purpose? What is its guiding purpose? What holds it together? What's its...
It's supposed to be a short
Yeah.
Outline. Easy to memorize.
Yeah.
Halacha.
Halacha.
Right.
The first Shulchan Aruch. And also includes the Masorah by bringing who said what.
In other words, the assumption tends to be that the Mishnah is some sort of code or handbook of halacha, the first handbook of halacha, and it's as halacha develops, other ones get written. So it's periodically you have to write new ones because things change, and so then you get the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch and what have you. The problem with that is that if that's true, they did a pretty bad job. Yehuda HaNasi just didn't do a good job.
What did you leave out?
What? It's not what do you leave out, it's how do you organize it. Let's look at the Rambam. I still have my bookmark.
Yeah, but that's something that they wrote so that you would learn it with a Rav. It wasn't meant to be...
Okay, but that's interesting. But the claim that... It's a question of what is this, what's the point? In other words, what's its purpose? So there seems to be a general assumption. Yeah.
The Rambam was writing for a different audience. The same way here, when the Mishnah was writing it, the question was... Well, the cat's out of the bag. Well, most of the Amcha didn't necessarily know this because they weren't learning the Mishnah.
Okay, that's a very serious question of who was actually learning Mishnah.
So by the time already Rambam, Klal Yisrael was already in Galus for how many years? Everybody had to have a certain level of something.
Okay, I'm not sure. We'll get through. When we see the Rambam, we see the Mishnah. I'm not sure if it's necessarily... I think it's relevant. It's not really relevant to the question of masses versus somewhat elite texts. But still, we have to ask, how is this thing why is this organized? If this is meant to be organized as some sort of systematic handbook, why does it, is this
it's
the best
really
way of
not.
Doing it?
I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. So the question is, how does the Rambam present Hilchot Kriyat Shema?
Are the Roman laws...
He took a look at the Mishnah and said, this isn't organized.
Yeah. Roman law is a little complicated. Whatever. I'll talk about Roman law afterwards.
Well,
Roman law is complicated.
What set of laws in those days made sense to this?
Roman laws are pretty organized. Yes, if you look at what's his name, yes, there are pretty... Yes, they're reasonably organized.
It's supposed to be memorized. No?
Yeah. So, but so is what's called. So is the Gemara. I mean, so
was
a lot of things. Yeah, the Gemara was sure. Everything was Baal Pen, so much later.
I'm saying, was it a fixed text of Gemara that's supposed to be?
Was the Mishnah fixed text? Okay, that's
but
part
he,
of the question.
He preserved a lot of the, I think, the conversational kind of discourse. It's not, you know.
So that's the question. First, I want to sort of establish a baseline for what a systematic approach would be, which is the Rambam. And then
take topics.
What? How does he start? Pa'mayim b'chol yom korin kriyat shema ba'erev v'voker. Shneimar v'shachval u'kumecha. V'shash derech bnei adam shochvin v'zehu laila. V'shash derech bnei adam omdim v'zehu yom. U'mahu kore shlosha parshiyot elohein shema v'ayim shema v'ayim. What does he do? He opens up. He says there's something called Shema. You've got to say it twice a day. He tells you this is the chiyuv. This is the source. He quotes the pasuk. And then he tells you what it is. This is Shema. And then he goes and somewhere on Halacha Tet. So Halacha Tet. He says Eizeh Uzman Kriyat Shema Balayla, but that's it's a detail. It's right.
Well, all the other things that they were Jewish, they probably knew.
Well, it's a question of knew, but the
or
question
practiced.
Is. But that's true. But the question is, what I'm saying is, but that's exactly the point. But you're dealing with a totally different approach. But that's also true for the Rambam. Every person in the Rambam also knows that you have to say Shema. But the Rambam leaves nothing to chance. Right? If you want to know how to present law in a systematic and conclusive, all-inclusive way, pick up the Rambam. And then you see, so the Shulchan Aruch, so you think the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quite meet the Rambam standard, but more or less he's doing the same thing. So it doesn't...
If you take away brachos, I think it makes sense. You start from Zeraim, you go through...
Okay, so that's the question. I don't know what this is. Okay, so that's the question. I'm not sure what the, in terms of the ordering... First of all, I'm not sure the ordering of the Siddurim, where that comes from.
Within, you go through the Masechet of Zeraim, I think they seem kind of...
No, the ordering of the Siddurim. The ordering of the Masechetos, the ordering of the Siddurim. In other words, when did Zeraim come first? That's what I'm not sure of. You have to look. There are a few places where they're listed in the Gemara. You have to see what order they're in. And you have to see if there's a consistent order. But the question, order of the Masechet, the order of the Masechet is pretty straightforward. The order of the Masechet is in size order within any given Seder. Within the Mishnah, the Gemara has different order, different orders basically. But one exception to that is Zrayim, where you sort of have two sets of, it's two sub-things. So it's not clear. But the ordering is a fairly mechanical thing, it seems. For in terms of Mishnayos, once again, this same sense that things aren't being laid out. But basically, you're not doing, one thing that you're not doing is laying things out in a sort of systematic manner. Now, the Rambam, what does the Rambam say? What does he say the purpose of his text book is? Does anyone know?
Should have all the Torah in one place.
Yeah.
Well, that's all
you
have to read.
All you need in life is the Mishnah Torah and the Tanakh. And that's it. And that's why, I mean, as some people say, that's why the story of Purim isn't in. He never explains why what Purim is for. But Hanukkah, he goes through this whole thing about why we celebrate Hanukkah, but Purim, he doesn't. Read Tanakh. It's not a problem. But anything else, he needs to tell you. So it's meant to be an autonomous work. Work that you can start front to back is totally self-explanatory. Now, there's really no such thing as an autonomous work, but at least as far as it can go, it's totally self-explanatory, and it's totally self-contained, with the exception of Tanakh at its basis.
Does he say to start running at 10?
What?
Does he say to start running at age 10?
What, Mishnah Torah? whatever. I was just talking to Mark Smilowitz about whether I'm about these things. He said that it's not what people think, but... the question is whether the Rambam really thought people should learn Gemara, or whether or not he just made the Gemara obsolete. No. So apparently there's a debate about that. But one way or another, that's sort of one possible model. The other side, you have the Mishnah. The Mishnah, first of all, how does it start with? What does it start with?
A question.
Starts with a question. Alright. It already starts in dialogue with itself. Right? There's already a question. It's and it doesn't explain to you. Meima Taikori Kriyat Shema ba'Aravit means that there's something called Kriyat Shema that has to be said at night and has a set time. The Rambam tells this to you. The Gemara, the Mishnah, just takes it for granted, starts midstream, and starts talking about this one little detail. Now, the question is, how are we to understand this? Now, I think we think about this in terms of the way we tell stories, from stories we're used to reading and in movies. Some stories begin, once upon a time, there was a man, and he lived in this city, and he had a wife and so many kids, and he was a lawyer, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they lay out everything you need to know about the story, and then they start telling the story. That's what the Rambam's doing. Nothing's left to chance. Now, the question is what's the Mishnah doing? Now, some stories will begin just with some character walking down the street. And as you go on, and this is what's considered normative for modern literature, for modern novel, you figure out who this guy is, and he starts talking, and he comes home, and you figure out, oh, that must be his wife. And, oh, he must have kids. No? And he starts talking, says, oh, he says he has a big case tomorrow, he must be a lawyer. And the reader eventually figures it all out. You have to reconstruct the world of the story piece by piece. Now, what's the advantage of that?
It sucks you into your part of the story.
It brings you in. So that's one way. That's certainly the way in which outsiders read the Mishnah. You have to reconstruct the details based on the Mishnah. And that's a very important exercise, because sometimes the Mishnah, what the Mishnah actually was intending, or the Mishnah was actually assuming, is different from what the Gemara says it was. So in order to understand, in order to get pshat in the Mishnah, often you have to release all preconceptions and see what is the Gemara assuming about the halacha, as opposed to just coming to it with all of our baggage. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is something like this. When someone makes a Spider-Man movie, a James Bond movie, so James Bond just appears. Spider-Man just appears. And there's never any effort to explain who this person is, where he came from, why he's doing what he's doing, right? I mean, there's an original movie. But after that, or the Spider-Man 1, the first comic book. But after that, none of that is explained. And, and James Bond, you have to know, you explain, it's not, Moneypenny and M and Q and all these people, they just show up and you're supposed to know who they are. And you're supposed to understand what's happening and why he's talking, why. There's all history to this. Why is that? How does that work? It doesn't work because you should be able to, which you might anyways be able to figure out what's going on and figure out from the context, this guy's a secret agent, that must be the boss and that must be the secretary. It's because the assumption is anyone who's watching this movie knows everything about this character already. You know who these characters are. You know who the good guys are. You know who the bad guys are. And that's all assumed. And that's a totally different... even though the story can look the same as a story which starts with an anonymous character that the reader didn't know about before, wasn't supposed to know about before, they're really two very different ways of telling a story. I think most likely the Mishnah is really taking the second track. It's not a question of drawing you in. It's a question that it's a text that isn't autonomous. It's a text that, by definition, functions in a context that's in dialogue, and it's dialogue with the reader also, because the assumption is that you know all of these things. And if you don't know all of these things, then what are you doing reading this book, right? Just like if you give, you know, it's like, I don't know, I saw this movie and there was this guy and he was swinging from things that came out of his hands and it made all no sense. It's like, okay, so why do you go to see a Spider-Man movie if you have no, right? Only someone who has a sheichus to this is going to be interested. The Mishnah fundamentally is, the Mishnah is assuming that it's a book for insiders, as you were saying. It's a book for, for people who have already learned, who already know something, not for people who are coming from the outside. The advantage and the problem with this is that, on the one hand, it does create a certain, you know, link between the community of readers and students and teachers and the text itself. And on the other hand, it does make it to a certain extent inaccessible. I mean, the concern is, you know, the Mishnah talks, there's a famous Midrash Tanchuma, in which Moshe says to God, write down the entire Torah. Why are you only writing down the Torah Shebichtav? And God says, because it's going to happen in the future that the Goyim are going to come and they're going to translate the Torah and they're going to say Anu Yisrael, which is a blatant reference to Christianity. And I'm going to come down and say, my children are the ones who have my mysterion. What's the mysterion? The Mishnah. In other words, by definition, once you've written something down, then it can be translated, it can be copied over, and therefore anyone can get it. If it's all oral, then it's by definition confined to the community. It's not going to be transmitted. Or as Joseph Kennedy supposedly once said, never write anything down that you don't want published on the front page of the New York Times.
I think that's why all the more fortunate don't use punctuation.
It wasn't invented. Punctuation was... You really should appreciate the period more than that lowly little dot.
I totally appreciate
it. Okay, it's the same. It's invented. So the people who invented the period, you know. look, at least we have word spacing, you know. That took a long time to invent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, sure. So therefore, the Mishnah is in this dialogue with its surrounding. What happens, though, is that when the surrounding changes, then the meaning's going to change. Because if you don't explain everything, it's obvious to us, you know, Kori Netzach Shema Ba'arvi, but, you know, some of these things just, we'll see what might have changed. But, but it's not clear, for us here it doesn't say explicitly, what is Mishasha Kohen Nichnasin Lechol B'Trumatan? It just assumes that you know. Well, already by the time of the Gemara, it's not clear what they're referring to. So it's very good when everyone understands. The problem is when things change, when things shift, then things are left misunderstood. Now you could say that's the strength of it. The text keeps getting, it's open to interpretation and it generates the certain interpretation. Okay. Now, another part of this dialogue nature of the Mishnah is the range of forms they have in the Mishnah. The Mishnah has a relatively wide range of forms than most halachic texts and most legal texts in general. It starts with these general statements, it has all these little cases, it has stories, it has these whole long descriptions of things that happened at the Beis HaMikdash. There's a whole range of possible ways of explaining the halacha. And fundamentally, they more or less interchangeable, right? You can say, a person has to, I mean, just take this. I mean, we'll see here, but you could say, you could tell the law is that you must do this, or you could say a person who is in this situation, if this happens, then you must do this case, or you could tell a story about a particular ruling that happened, and more or less they're interchangeable. And the question is why you choose one or the other, and most legal texts therefore make relatively limited use. They choose one or two. They don't keep moving back and forth like this. The Mishnah keeps moving back and forth. And this is a prime example, right here in the first Mishnah, where you have this story of Rabban Gamliel. Now, first of all, let's just look at the story first. The story doesn't teach us any halacha. As it already said, we know Rabban Gamliel's position. Right? We don't need the story to teach us the halacha. So the question is, what is the story doing for us?
It illustrates.
What does that mean?
Well, they said the halacha, and then they tell where it came from.
Ah, so you could say that's the source.
Right.
How do we know that's the source?
Or
but
the
then
proof
what? A proof. But if that's the proof, once again, but why not just eliminate the formulation? Just tell the story, which happens all the time in the mission.
Or skip the story.
Or skip the story. Right. What do you mean? What?
Every textbook fails to have examples. And sometimes an example is exactly what it says on there.
Again, this is also oral law.
The question
is, it was meant to be a memorable thing. They tell a story.
Okay, that's a question of memorization. That's a whole what's it called. That I think is, that's... We have no concept of what memorization means. I can't remember my own phone number. I mean, cell phones keep changing. I have no idea. I have to write on the back of the cell phone. I'm talking about our capacity to memorize is so...
Limited
relative to what the actual human mind can memorize.
To what they have to memorize.
And what I'm saying is, therefore, we have no sense. But the part of the way they did it wasn't just that people just have these memories. They had techniques for doing this.
Right.
There's a brain. Not just stories. Huge systematic exercise. This is one of the great intellectual disciplines of many, many civilizations, including Chazal. And our memories, you have to exercise your memory and train your memory and form your memory into shapes that we don't even know our brain has a shape. Our memory has a shape. The whole thing, part of the whole question is people assume that if a text is oral, it can't be edited. The fact that you've seen that it's clear that someone has gone over a text carefully and made subtle changes in it means that there must have been a written text, because we cannot do that in our heads. You can't edit a text in your head. They could do it, it seems. It seems reasonable from what I understand from the historians, from what they know about this whole process. They could do that. It's very hard for us to get into and understand what it means, oral, because we have no sense of it. And also, to the extent that we know people who know huge amounts of Gemara and Mishnah Baal Peh, it's completely different from what they were doing. Because, right, they have a pin test. What does a pin test mean? A pin test means that you learned it from a book. It's a text. It's a printed text. It's a written text, which you've memorized. In those days, there was no pin test because there was no text. Anyone, this is all, it's purely oral. It's a totally different mode of engaging text. We really can't, and that's why I basically...
I think that explains a lot of the stylistic characteristics here. I thought the Mishnah was put together from conversations of Tanaim, which to me goes a long way in explaining the sort of idiosyncratic presentation and the style of
the
dialogues, the stories,
and also moving from
what I'm arguing is the exact opposite.
Lack of organization,
right.
And what I'm arguing is the exact opposite. Is that the Rambam could have just easily been composed
like that,
orally, by people who knew what they were doing. That's my understanding. The point is that we don't that our notion of what oral things are and what memorized things are, it just simply doesn't serve for what they were doing. It's just a whole different technology. This is one of the most important things. And Chazal were amazing because they were literate.
Illiterate.
They were literate. They were, of course, they were all literate. They all read the Torah. You couldn't be a Talmud Chacham without being able to read. So it wasn't some ancient civilization which they could all read, and they nevertheless chose this mode. And the question is, you know, why and how? But like I said, we're just so far away that when people say this is a mnemonic device that makes it easier to remember, it's like it's just such a different world.
But we use it as a mnemonic device, is not what they would
do. I don't. It's just hard to. It's just that you can tell. I'm saying is I don't think you can really tell from the function of a text whether or not it's oral or written from the stylistics of the text. That's why I find very problematic. And this is based on we have a lot of preconceptions, but I think that but you just see all the stuff they seem to have been memorizing, and it's all different. Okay, so what's this story though? What's our story? Is this? Who are the characters?
His children.
Who's he? Rabban Gamliel and his children are the characters. Mm-hmm. What's the setting?
I always thought they were out partying.
Okay, so this is something. What's called? Yeah. So I had a friend in Boston who was always very upset at all these rabbis who had to say, "See, they went out partying and they it was a wedding, right? It was a wedding." The term mishneh means a wedding. I checked this out once.
Well, this is fashion, right?
Right. But I checked out basically that's what the word means. It's
okay.
it's a tempting reading, but so what are the setting? What's the setting of the story?
They're out. They're at home.
Right. The setting's at home, but what else is there?
The nighttime.
Well, it's at night, but what else is there other than the house? There's another stage, conceptually.
When are they telling him the story? When it happened,
when
he announced
Salah?
But
no, they come and say, "Oops, we didn't
say Shema."
He said, "Don't worry, you have to tell him what
Shachar." Right,
maybe they thought it was the Chassod.
Basically, they thought it was the Chassod. Yeah.
When did he say Achiyaleh Amudat Shachar? After he heard this story or before?
That's the question. It doesn't say. That's the sort of thing that's left ambiguous. It's one of those ambiguities in the Gemara, in the Mishnah. The Mishnah rarely explains the relationship between the story and the halacha, and sometimes you can't tell if it's supporting the halacha, amending the halacha, or opposing the halacha. And the Gemara has very definite opinions about this, but that doesn't always follow from the Mishnah necessarily. So there are a lot of chisuri mechzeras in the Gemara around these sorts of stories, where the Gemara inserts entire paragraphs or entire extra lines into the story, which a lot of people feel is not, the Gemara is post facto. It's not the Gemara has a mesora that these lines were there. They have their own issues and their own assumptions, but it's not clear that it's necessarily shot in the Mishnah. So what do we have? We've got father and two sons. We've got the house. And what else do we have?
Chachamim.
No, place. No chachamim.
Close to chachamim.
No, that's later. That's not part of the story.
Is it the father?
Where else? What else? What other place is there? The Beit HaMishneh. Right? So, from a structural point of view, what do we have? We have fathers and sons. We have the house of the father versus the house of the party, of the wedding. Right? And to a certain extent, there's a certain conflict here. I mean, this is a little story about a father-son, a parental, intergenerational interaction. I mean, I always have this picture from the time I was a kid. I always have this picture of these two, teenagers coming in through the back, through the kitchen door and the back door, sort of, trying to close the door quietly, hoping not to wake anyone up at 2:30 in the morning. And then in the dark, they notice there's the little light. They see that Rav Gamliel is sitting there in his bathrobe, chazering daf yomi. And, and they're like, they're caught. You always think no one wants, the kids don't want to know what, they think they get in, no one will know when they got in. And there he is. And there's a certain sense. And it's all resolved, because it turns out they're okay. Because if he had come back and he had said, no, you're in trouble, because you didn't say Shema.
You missed it.
So then that would be a real break between the father and son. The father's at home. He clearly said Shema already. They went out, and they blew it. But it all comes together. This tension, this potential crisis, is averted. But the crisis seems to be between the world of the Beit HaMishteh versus the world and the world of youth versus the world of the Beit HaMidrash and the world of the Zakenim, of elders, and which we saw already in the contest between the two wives, the old wife and the young wife. And the question is, and ultimately it seems that some sort of happy medium, some sort of dialogue is created between the two, because everything works out. They got to go to the wedding and then they came home and everything was fine. So you can dance at both chasanas, as it were. So, but I think, and this is why it's important that it's a wedding, it's not so simple, because nevertheless, These young men still have a mitzvah, which Rabbi Gamliel doesn't really have, to go out to weddings.
Mark, doesn't he have to go to weddings?
No, because they're the shoshavim. The point is, it's a particular mitzvah of the friends of the chasam.
Oh.
So these are the young men going out to the friend, So obviously that Rabbi Gamliel got invited to weddings, but these rabbis, they leave after the shmorgasbord, right? So if there is a shmorgasbord, yeah.
I don't think they had shmorgasbord.
You don't think so?
No, I'm going to prove it.
Yeah, that's a serious theological proposition. I think there are people in Brooklyn who put you into chayrim for suggesting that it's not hostile to Moshe Messina. But you'll be in good company if they put you into chayrim. So what we have on the one hand is a story that has a coherence of its own and lets us into a world and shows a certain conflict, just like any other story. But then, also, the story teaches us halacha. And clearly what it's doing here is to teach us halacha, except for the fact that it's not. One possibility is to say, well, it's to get us this sort of this image of this relationship and what have you. But what I think is really going on is a question of the very nature of halacha. That, as I said, you can always choose how to formulate your halacha. You can always do it, thou shalt not, and say, could if this, then that. Or you could say, once upon a time, this happened. You could tell a story about when they enacted the law. You could tell a story about how when someone ruled like that. All sorts of possibilities. But what I would argue is that even if, from the point of view of the law, there's no difference. This isn't Pesachim. Pesachim, you have to fall asleep in the large Pesachim. Rather, it tells you something about the very nature of the law. The Rambam has a very clear conception of the law, that you don't need to read Mor Nevuchim or any of the more theoretical parts, the introductory parts of the Mishnah Torah, to understand what it is. It's very clear. Halacha is a system. There are principles, there are general rules, and from that, everything else is derived. And the application is ultimately secondary. The most important thing is this abstract thing called the law, the ultimate eternal truths of the Torah. And then, of course, since we're human, we have to apply them this way, that way. But that merely flows from the first principles. That's one way of looking at it. Let's pour me a glass of water, please. And what that means then also is that the truth is out there. Thank you. In other words, it doesn't matter who you are. You can find the truth of the law. And even if you only know one thing, that's what you know, that's what you've proven, it's true. In math, no one cares who you are. If you have a good proof for your claim, so that's it, you've proved it, and it doesn't matter that you've outdone the biggest mathematicians in the world. You have a proof, either you have a proof or you don't. No one really cares who you are. It's totally anonymous. It's not invested in the person. Person's authority is only based on the fact that they have this law inside them. They've learned the law. To the extent that they know the law, they have authority. To the extent that they don't know the law, they don't have authority. It's that simple. And if they're wrong, they're wrong. That's one model. The opposite model, on the opposite side, so like I said, you take the Rambam, you could take something like that comes out of the Rambam, something like Rav Chaim, any really abstract sort of learning, where once again the idea is to break the halacha down to its core principles and ideas. You know, the Rav writes in Ish Halacha certainly comes out of that world. The Rav writes in Ish Halacha about this, you know, psak, you know, they don't get involved in psak. The whole thing with briskers, don't get involved in psak. There are lots of explanations as to why they don't, but one of them is this notion that actually deciding how much cake you have to eat to make a ba'al mechia is just not, you know, that's not real halacha. That's just, you know, it's the application. Leave it to the, you know, leave it to the underlings. We do the big picture. We do the important stuff. They say it's like the theoretical physicists versus the engineers. Or the story about, you know, the mathematician who sees a fire in his hotel room. He sees the ice bucket. He sees the sink. He sees that there is a solution and goes back to sleep. Right? He solved the problem. So what's the problem, right? So that's one far side. The other side is to say, no, what is halacha? What is the essence of halacha? The essence of halacha is picking up this cup and saying shahakol on this cup of water. Because it's actual embodiment in day-to-day life. And the fact that from this we might abstract bigger principles, well, that might be useful and helpful to us sometimes, but that's not ultimately what's important. And the embodiment of that is going to be, in our world, is going to be, among other possibilities, is going to be something like the Shemira Shabbos Kilchasa. Very little conceptual explanation of what's going on in the Shemira Shabbos. Shemira Shabbos isn't organized around conceptual categories, it's around practical categories, things in your cabinet. Can you open them or not? But it's basically, you know, halachas, you know, kids on Shabbos. it's not the Rambam. We have to figure out how it fits in to his conceptual framework, figure out where some practical halacha is going to be. There, the implication is that what really counts, what really matters, and this is, seems to be the mainstream approach to learning, even if theologically people still seem to think in the other term, in the Rambam's terms, but in practical modes, this is what people seem to think Torah is in the contemporary world. That's where most of the emphasis is exactly that, is figuring it out. There's a book, there's Marash HaKol, and we learned Hilchos Muksa, and there is this Muksa book floating around, not the Muksa book, which is an important landmark because it was one of the first real of these popular halacha books in English with the Hebrew footnotes that really set the stage. But there's another book of some guy, basically, it wasn't clear this guy knew anything. He used to go into Rosh Shlomo Zalman with boxes of stuff, and he'd hold them up, and Rosh Shlomo Zalman would say, Klei Shel Machpel L'Isser. Pick up another one, and he'd say, Muksa Machmas Chasar and Kis. And basically, and he'd write it all down, and he reported this stuff. And then I thought it was like the ultimate, like, you know, and there was like no, what's it called? And there was this, you got like the most bizarre things. You asked him about the status of those light sticks that you break in half. He says, and Rosh Shlomo Zalman said, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. But if it gives off light, there's a good chance that it's Aser. Like, this is the great Pesach Rosh Shlomo Zalman. He never went to the circus.
Or a bat mitzvah.
No, because obviously in his neighborhood, they gave the kids real torches to carry, as opposed to in our neighborhood where we give them those sticks. But so that's, I think, sort of is an opposite extreme. But that extreme also takes into that notion, also takes into the notion that therefore what embodies the halacha is the individual story. The story of the individual event is the halacha, and therefore that's the essence of the halacha. It's precisely that. It's precisely that this story that Rabbi Gamliel Paskin this in this case to his sons on this night is more essential in a certain sense, in that view, than making the general statement. What it also does, by the way, is it makes the position of the Rav very different. Because it becomes much more, if the halacha doesn't come out of those first principles, so where does it come from?
Mesorah.
It comes from Mesorah, but what's Mesorah? Mesorah is something that's embodied in these rabbis. But once you are a Baal HaMesorah, what you say is the halacha, right? And that's why these stories say, well, Rabban Gamliel did this, and therefore that's the halacha. And now you could say, well, so-and-so disagreed, fine. But the notion that the person's actions, that the Rav, or the Talmid Chacham, is the embodiment of the halacha, and therefore his actions are the source of halacha, and perhaps the essential source of halacha, and everything else is just sort of, you know, one step removed. Then you can formulate it as a statement, as happens here.
So, chronologically, I mean, they have the statement first and then the story. And very often in the Mishnah, it's like that, not always.
That's true, it's not always. But the question is, what does that mean? Do you mean chronologically that's first? Or do you mean that you stated it, but now we're telling you what the source is? And there's,
right.
Is it being at the beginning or being at the end, we still don't know which one's more important.
In most expository texts, the idea comes before the illustration or the example. Or whatever.
But on the other hand, it happens all the time that someone will say, this is the halacha, how do I know? Because when I was in yeshiva, blah, 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 and so now I know. This is what you have to do, right? Because I went to Revel Yashiv, and I asked him about Crocs, and he said he can't wear them on Yom Kippur. So now we know. But you might not say that in the first statement, but that doesn't mean that that's not, but there's still a certain priority to the Maaseh, right? That the Maaseh isn't an enactment of a pre-existing principle, but rather
the principle comes
from that action, right?
It's and, the Ikar, not the Tafel.
Well, I'm saying Ikar Tafel almost becomes difficult to...
Sometimes we have the only answer on that case, because that was the case that came before them. So
well, that's the problem. The problem is that you can't really make halacha out of these individual cases, that they're all individual cases. And what always often happens in the Mishnah is you never know, extrapolating is very difficult, particularly because there's always one more detail that you could say, right, which will totally change the course. And they say, well, they used to wrap it in, they used to wrap their lovin' in gold. Right? So he says, you can't hold it. What does he say? So they say, no, but what you don't know is really underneath they were holding it with a lulav or something. Okay. Right? And there's always some more detail, right? The whole question of, right, there's some detail often which is unseen, which the narrator doesn't have access to, as it were. Right, the story about Rav Moshe Feinstein picking up the thing of milk, of non-Chol of Yisrael milk, and then putting it down, and then taking what's it called? and then taking the Chol Yisrael. Now, so one version of the story says, you see, he put it down when given a choice. He definitely drank Chol Yisrael. The other version of the story has it, no. The milk, which happened not to have been Chol Yisrael, happens also to have been empty, whereas the one that just happens to have been Chol Yisrael was full. Now, to the narrator from the outside, you can't tell the difference. So that means we can always speculate about it, which means it's a very problematic way of transmitting halacha. And that's what that's what the Gemara is constantly fighting over. And the Gemara is constantly, what does the Gemara do? It recontextualizes the halachas so that they're not relevant to the case that they didn't want it to be relevant to, or that they didn't think it could be relevant to. So what the Gemara is doing then, what the Mishnah is doing by juxtaposing these two, I'm arguing, is basically throwing up both theories.
Juxtaposing
the story with the statement. Is that there, which like I said, is very rare to do that in other sorts of law. What they're doing is they're throwing out both stories. The Mishnah seems to move back and forth, once again, this dialogue, between these two different views. On the one hand, there's a reason why people mistake it for a systematic code, because there's a lot in the Mishnah which makes you feel like you're reading a systematic code. Sometimes the Mishnah really is very systematic. There is, it's not, even when you read cases, often the cases clearly suggest some sort of underlying principle. But the Mishnah never says it. So there's this. So what happens is there's sort of this tension between these two different ways. And what the Mishnah is doing is precisely not taking a stand on this question. Precisely not taking a stand on the nature of the Rav's authority. And therefore allowing all of this to be in play. And once it's all in play, then we can work it through. But it doesn't. But it feels that fundamentally the law has to be both. Which is true. Ultimately the law does have to be both. Right. There's lots of systems recognize this. They don't do it this way. In other words, lots of systems have case law and statutory law, but they have to interact somehow. But what most places do is put them in separate books. In the courtroom, the lawyer has to figure out how to integrate them. But that statement is not made by the that statement is not made by the books, by the form of the books. The Mishnah, I'm arguing, is making that sort of statement of this sort of complex relationship. And this ultimately draws in this complex, because what the question of the complex relationship between halacha and agada, because once you start getting into the fabric of real life, then you get into these stories. And it might be that this story, the whole Mishnah is just there because there's a story in there, that's agada. Right? So that's
Rabban Gamliel's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's grandfather?
Rabban Gamliel is, assuming this is Rabban Gamliel, so this is Rabban Gamliel II. Yes, Rabban Gamliel is his grandfather, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could that be relevant for his opening?
I think it's relevant in other cases. I think there are cases where it is possible that arguments about the Mishnayos that talk about Rabban Gamliel's authority might be not so subtly arguing for Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's authority. Mm-hmm. That's the relevance. Why are they so obsessed with Rabbi Gamliel's authority? Because what they're making is a very current issue about Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's authority, and he's making his argument by saying, my grandfather had all these powers, so therefore I should have them. And that's a different question. That's for Rosh Hashanah, not for Brachos. Okay.
So just to clarify. So basically what you're saying is by using these different means of presenting issues, it's basically opening issues up for discussion more than trying to
close off. Yeah, now clearly,
I mean, then the Gemara came along and said, wait a second, we're going to decide.
No, but the Gemara, most of the time the Gemara doesn't do that. Most of the time the Gemara just further opens up. The Gemara finds issues that look like they're closed in the mission and opens them up.
Yeah.
Right? Either because they really weren't closed because there was another opinion in a Braita somewhere, or because the Gemara manages to treat it. But what I argue is that the Gemara is premised on the fact that the Mishnah has all this slippage in it. And that you can't, and it's precisely because of that fact that there's always another possible reading. And even if we would say it's not the most likely reading, the Mishnah is constantly opening up. It leaves enough out that the Gemara can always say, oh, but this is the other case. This is really the case. You can't necessarily do that as easily to all texts. The Mishnah is, the Gemara isn't just, the Gemara might be, the precisely because the Gemara isn't pshat in the Mishnah a lot of the time, might make it the most authentic reading of the Mishnah. Because it's precisely keeping in mind the complexity and the ambiguity of the text. As opposed to just saying, okay, it's complex and ambiguous, but Soph Kol Soph, was it said? Which is what we're trained to do, and which has a value. But And therefore they're able to sort of they're working through. Obviously, they're constantly sticking in, particularly the Bavli is constantly sticking in, you know, knives into these little cracks in the Mishnah, and right, prying them open. But the fact is, those cracks are there. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they're not cracks; they're actual gaps, and then they're just, you know, knocking them open.
And how's this related to Agadah?
It's here. I told you I'm going through the Yom Yaakov.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's related the issue of Agadah. It's related to the issue of the relationship between Halacha and Agadah, because once you've let in the world of stories once you've recognized stories as a mode of transmitting law, you've almost inevitably blurred the line. You don't have to. Because I know someone who's done very similar work to mine, made very similar arguments on late 19th century British law, and there the stories are all boring. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, once you've done that, you've opened up, you've blurred the line, because you've opened up this world of storytelling, and clearly the storytelling takes on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. And that's clearly what, that's what happens in a lot of cases of stories, which are just deemed agadic, but in fact, they come clearly out of this whole halachic world. They start with a halachic discussion, but the story just sort of gets going. And the story picks up on, and the story often is still concerned with these larger meta-halachic issues. But so this is part of what creates that blur, part of what generates Agadah in the Mishnah and ultimately in the Bavli, which is supposed to be, how did the Bavli get to all this stuff? Well, because the Mishnah in some cases is pushing towards it, in some cases it's not. Sometimes it's just, you know.
How do you view the conclusion of the Mishnah? Kedei l'archik et adam min ha'avera. Is that legalistic?
We mentioned the fact that, you know, on a certain level it's sort of self-defeating. Once they told you, so right, what's the point? But I don't know. Just the last thing, very quickly.
It seems somewhat agadic.
What? Okay, slate. So we'll finish. Yeah. What?
Is this typical of the Mishnah that they do it this way, or is it?
Yeah. I mean, this is my general argument that the Mishnah sort of juxtaposes these sorts of things. The stories are there. You often can't tell. That's all the Masa List story. The Gemara can raise the question, what is this story doing here? The Gemara has a rule. There's no such thing as Masa List story, which is problematic. The Gemara assumes that a story cannot come to challenge the stated halacha. But that's because they have a series of priorities, that stories are an inferior way of transmitting halacha. But the Mishnah doesn't say that anywhere.
Well, quickly, when I think of Masechet with Agadah, we always think of Masechet Brachos.
Right.
But the places in the Mishnah where they tell stories, Baba Kama or Baba Metzia, it's very, you don't think of them as the Masechta which have stories.
But there are, what's, what do you mean?
But they're not, essentially, in other words, when you think of Masechta, when you learn a Masechta, you pick up and choosing a Masechta to do. And you say, this is a good one, a lot of stories in it, right? That's how they usually find it. No, it's all Habacha, right? Whatever it is, the amount of stories in the Mishnah is not.
There's no correspondence to the number of stories in the Mishnah. But what I'm arguing is that, but there are, we can discuss this next time. I believe there are reasons why there are other reasons why these Masechta generate Agadah. Though sometimes, like I said, they just start going. But it's not shocking that Megillah generates a lot of Agadah, and then this is the point where the Bavli decides to insert their entire commentary on the Megillah, right? I'm saying it's not a lot, you know. But Brachos is a separate issue. It'll probably come up as we go through it. Okay.
Very good. What about Einaya?
What?
Einaya, that's a comment.
Never used it. I assume it comes out of this, you know, capitalist tradition, which I don't really know how to understand. But I just, I suffice with reading the Marsha and understanding that. Yeah.